a dancer. She is a professional. She is a patient. She is a wife. She is a mother. She's a spectacular speaker when it comes to the intersection of patient advocacy, health data rights, and the art within us all. If we could please welcome Kim Martin.
Thank you, Regina. That was a wonderful introduction. Thank you, everyone. This is so great to see people I don't get to see as often as I would like. What a treat this is. What a treat this really is. So thank you. Did you all have a good day today?
Yes!
So I really wished we could have gotten here to enjoy the sessions today. I can imagine how amazing they were. Really look forward to hearing about those as we convene for the night. Today, I'm really grateful to have a chance to spend some time with you all. Some of you know a good portion of my story. I'll share some new information today that you may not be aware of. And then also, just for the last 2 years is really when I've been spending most of my time doing advocacy. And some of the lessons I've learned along the way, some of the successes that I've experienced. And I think as a group of very empowered, passionate advocates and a community, a tribe, we have a real opportunity to align in new ways, to have greater impact across the industry. So with that, I'd like to think about our stories as business strategies. My life is my message, just as your life is your message. And how we convey our message to the world is really important, especially in healthcare. So survival, as a cancer survivor, is a theme that's been pretty consistent in my life, but it started well before my first cancer diagnosis at age 17. Surviving my childhood, I think, at times may have been more difficult than surviving cancer, honestly. And some of you are nodding your head, yeah. So as a young child, I'm an only of two people, two parents who have very good hearts, but are products of their troubled childhood. And my parents divorced when I was 3. And when my mother left my father, she moved into the only apartment she could afford, which was an efficiency in a roadside motel that my grandmother managed, so the rent was cheap. And for 4 years, that's where I lived. Living in a motel on a roadside highway, with the only companion around my age being my uncle, my mother's youngest brother, who was 3 years older, was not a time in my life I have the fondest of memories, but it certainly was a time that taught me resiliency and self-sufficiency, because I really became a latchkey kid by the age of 4. So throughout my life, I've learned to be resourceful, I've learned to be independent, I've learned to really take care of myself in ways that at such a young age we shouldn't have to. But I look back on it as a gift because it's gotten me through 4 cancer diagnoses and other challenges that have gotten me here today. Let me just take a step back. For those of you who don't know my story, I'm a 4-time cancer survivor, 32 years since my first diagnosis back in 1983. I was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma the month after I turned 17. And at the time, I thought I felt pretty good. I had classic symptoms, though. I had the chronic cough, I was tired, I had fatigue, and I had lost weight. Now, my lifestyle at the time was I was a smoker, I was a partier, and I really wasn't much of a foodie. So I could justify all those symptoms because they matched with my lifestyle. And I think a lot of us know people today that really, because of lifestyle choices, they feel pretty good. In some cases, that's true. In others, we just need to be very mindful. Had my right arm not gone numb, I'm not sure I'd be here today because I was blowing off the other symptoms. And the reason that my right arm went numb was I had a lymph node enlarged to the size of an egg that sat on the artery and cut the circulation to my arm. So I really, at the time, didn't understand cancer. I didn't understand my body. So I delegated all of my healthcare decisions to my parents and my providers. Now, the disease was caught early. I had 40 rounds of radiation. I had some surgery and got through it fairly unscathed on the spectrum of cancer treatment. I had 20 years of subsequent radiation follow-up, either through chest x-rays, mammograms I started in my 20s, which we don't recommend today, and CT scans as needed. Through the course of that experience, and this was in the 80s, where we didn't have the internet, we didn't have the support groups, I didn't have a tribe that I could reach out to. Being an independent person, I just internalized it and went on with my life and didn't talk about my experience for 15 years. And the reason I didn't talk about my experience was because even though I had a really great optimistic view that I could use that experience for the greater good, back then I was introduced to another teenager who was diagnosed with cancer, and this, you know, that was my tribe, and he was terminal. And it was a very rough experience for me, and I realized not everybody might be happy that I survived. So for 15 years, I didn't talk about my story, but I became more aware of my health. In my 20s, the radiation field on my body, which was full torso, started to change. I had more moles start to develop. And that was unusual, because my mother, it's just not our skin pigmentation. I'm Native American, and I went to my radiation oncologist, and I said, look, my skin's changing. I think it has to do with all the radiation I've been exposed to. And he looked at me and he said, there's no clinical evidence to support that finding. And I said, well, I'm evidence. My body's changing. So I took it upon myself at that time to start getting biannual mole checks. The first dermatology appointment I went to, the first mole I had removed, which is about the diameter of a pencil head eraser, was an evolving melanoma. So that set me on the track of becoming very diligent with not only dermatology checks, but self-checks. By the time I reached my 30s, I had had roughly 40 moles removed. I went to see a new dermatologist with a mole that was now the size of a pinhead. And I said, this mole is new, it's dark, and I'm pretty sure it's aggressive. And he looked at me and said, I don't think it's anything to worry about. I said, well, I do. So you need to take the mole. And sure enough, he called a week later to tell me it was, in fact, melanoma. Now, what I learned from that experience was not to let my doctors play God, not to be afraid to push back, and to really listen to my inner voice, if you will. Moving into my 40s, in 2012, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. That diagnosis was interesting because back in 2000, I had gone to Dana-Farber, and I talked to a research specialist about my risk for breast cancer based on all the radiation I'd been exposed to. And in 2000, he told me my risks were minimal above average, that prophylactic mastectomies would not be justified or covered. So I said, that's fine, I moved on. Fast forward to 2012, I have breast cancer. September was the month I was diagnosed. October was the month that ASCO, the American Society of Clinical Oncology, was actually hosting their annual meeting, which is a global meeting. My oncologist told me that they were actually making a formal announcement at that meeting that women in my category and class who had Hodgkin's lymphoma treated with radiation therapy had the same risk factor as women with the BRCA gene. So in a span of just over 10 years, my risk grew from just minimal over the average to about 60 to 70%, and was actually confirmed that, in fact, my breast cancer and my melanoma are both results of the radiation. Cancer doesn't run in my family. No one on either side of my parents, siblings, or extended family have ever had cancer. So the reason I share that is back when I was 17, I didn't take very good care of myself. And Hodgkin's lymphoma is cancer of your lymphatic system, your immune system. And I really believe that my lifestyle choices played a significant role in that diagnosis. because at the time, it was a very stressful period in my life, a lot of family drama, and I lived on caffeine, nicotine, and alcohol. And the body can only take that for so long before it breaks. So the reason I share that with you is 70% of cancers are lifestyle related. 30% are genetic. And there's a lot that we can do for our own health to prolong and ultimately prevent a diagnosis. And because statistics today are one out of two men and one out of three women will be diagnosed, we really want to be mindful of the impact of our lifestyle choices, because I truly believe had I taken better care of myself, I wouldn't be standing up here today telling you this story, because I don't think I would have ever developed cancer. So cancer number four, just to finish the story, was February of this year. And it was basal cell carcinoma, which is not a significant diagnosis by any means. And I even wondered, should I say I'm a 3.5-time cancer survivor, because is it really on the spectrum of cancer? And what's interesting about that is, as a proactive, engaged, empowered patient, I knew that for the rest of my life, I have to watch my skin issues. I have to be on the lookout for the next melanoma. And there's a procedure in dermatology called Mohs. And for those who aren't familiar, it's a really great, much less invasive opportunity to remove skin irregularities layer by layer. And at the time those layers are removed, the dermatologist analyzes that tissue. So when you leave the office, you know you have clear margins. Typically, to have a mole removed, they will take a section of tissue, send it out to a lab, and you wait 7 to 10 days for the result. So the Mohs procedure I figured I would need at some point. I didn't figure I would need it after my first visit with my dermatologist. And these two little moles that he found were behind my left ear that went undetected by my other dermatologists. And the thing with basal cell is it grows internal. So, and it can be disfiguring. So it may not be terminal, but it can certainly alter your physical being. So the Mohs procedure is something I really advocate for anyone who has to look at skin management, because it is a fabulous way. For speaking as someone who's literally had now close to 70 moles conventionally removed, advocate for the Mohs. Yeah. So after the breast cancer diagnosis, what I was able to do was I had the bilateral mastectomies and reconstruction, and I was able to decline chemo that was recommended. Now, I'm a holistic nutrition consultant, I'm a fitness trainer, and I my lifestyle is very green, if you will. So knowing that my second and third cancers were a result of the radiation therapy, I was very concerned about doing chemo because of the after effects that can come from the treatment. And because I know the body has such an ability to heal itself, given the right environment, I was praying there would be another alternative to manage my cancer, though I knew I didn't have enough information to take care of it on my own. I was blessed to work with an herbalist who's in Oregon. He specializes in oncology, and he has been managing my care for the last 2.5 years. We Skype call my consults every 3 months. We work only off of blood work that I have checked, that my internist orders. He can't interpret half of it, and he admits it, although he orders it for me so that my herbalist can interpret and deliver my care. My oncologist, who didn't agree with my decision but didn't think it was unreasonable, still agrees to see me. He's the one I go to for the poking and the prodding and the physical exams. And over the last 2.5 years, my blood markers have improved to the point where my oncologist actually now thinks that my markers, my three primary cancer markers, are benign indicators. So there are other alternatives to cancer treatment and management as well, and there are three outcomes. There's the two we always talk about, and then there's living with cancer. And I do live with the belief that I still have cancer because it keeps me grounded. It keeps me grounded in what matters. It keeps me grounded in making the most out of what time I do have. And it certainly keeps me aware and awake to what else might be waiting for me down the road. After I completed my surgeries, I was invited to start speaking in healthcare and tell my story and do advocacy. Now, Ross, my husband, who an amazing partner and, just his experience in HIT over the last 15 years that I've been able to witness from the periphery is pretty profound. He's been able to introduce me to a lot of the issues in healthcare that I would never otherwise know about on the inside. And he's been an incredible support to me and has been telling me for years, you gotta tell your story. And when I was just a Hodgkin's and melanoma survivor, I thought, who cares about that? That's not a story. And then when I was diagnosed with breast cancer, figured everybody can relate to that. And that was when the doors opened for me to start doing advocacy. And what I've learned in the last 2 years has been really fascinating. Most of you know this. You've been doing advocacy much longer than I have. So, the healthcare system is a pretty closed system when it comes to incorporating the patient voice and patient experience. And I really love that we as a community can do just this. We can build doors so that we can help the system heal, for lack of a better term. And it is based on our experience, our individual and collective experience. I think when we look at our stories and all that we've captured from having to navigate the system on, in most cases, a chronic level, do we sit and synthesize what we really learned and what we really took away and what we can really give back? Because I know for me, I have to do that. I have to sit down and think about what is my value back to the system from my experiences? And what's the wisdom? Because healthcare has a lot of knowledge, it has a lot of intelligence, and doctors do accumulate wisdom from working with large communities of patients. When they see consistent issues, they derive a lot of wisdom from that. But we as patients and caregivers have an incredible amount of wisdom that can't be accessed in any other way than through connecting with us. So I'd love for you to all think about the wisdom that you own from your experience and that you can package. Another thing I've learned is, as a passionate advocate, my story can get the best of me, for sure. So I've had to learn to focus my story and focus it for my audience, whether it's a one-on-one conversation or it's a room full of people. And that focus really helps me then think about my background in business, which is business development and strategic partnerships. And what's the real value that I bring to every encounter, whether, like I say, it's a conversation or a consulting opportunity? What am I adding? I thought about it before I came today. What am I adding to this experience for you all? Because many of you, like I said, have had more advocacy work and time in healthcare, in the trenches. I think from the organizations I've had the privilege of working with, I've been able to speak at a variety of conferences. I've been really honored to launch an organization called the Patient Experience Council that is a patient and caregiver-led organization. In 2 years, I've had an amazing ride. And as I've cultivated my story and my experience, I've realized that I need really new thinking, because healthcare is an old system. And coming at it as basically, the way I manage my care, I'm an engaged patient, I do integrative care, I do a lot of things that healthcare's not even talking about really yet, and that's okay. But it doesn't mean that I still can't plant seeds, I still can't get people thinking differently about how to either manage their own care or have providers deliver care differently. What I would ask of everyone here is, having given thought to your story as a business strategy. So business strategy, you've got to have basically a niche. So healthcare is so vast. What's our niche? Well, my niche is oncology, and it's integrative care, and it's business development. So what professional niches do we bring to the table? Because we all know healthcare seems to forget that we have other experience, professional, be it business development, technology, engineering, legal, all those skills for I don't know what reason become invisible when we are termed patients and caregivers. So I'd love for us to pull that professional experience back up front and package it with our story, because industry will connect with, I think, both on a deeper level. My experience in the last 2 years, that has been true. I've started speaking differently. I've started pulling in the terminology from my business days into conversations with executives about healthcare and the patient experience. And they get it. They resonate with that. So what skills do we bring to the table? And how do we package those? The more we can package ourselves as a product, and I don't mean to sound insensitive, but as a product, Regina's done an amazing job of this with her art and her creativity and her paintings and her books. E-patient Dave has done a great job of it as well. And the success that you're experiencing is no surprise. I mean, it's absolutely the trajectory, right? But I think for me, as I've walked these 2 years, really packaging myself as a product has been very helpful and beneficial and has opened a lot more doors. Knowing my value propositions, that's really important. The value that I believe we all bring to the table is the opportunity to help industry connect back out to patients clearly in very creative ways. And when I talk to executives, I say to them, I am your bridge. I attend these healthcare conferences because I want to know what's going on in the industry. I invest the time, I invest the resources. And I can take the innovation that you're working on, and I can take the progress, the advancements that you're committed to on behalf of patients and help patients who don't come to these conferences understand what's really happening. I can help the patients understand how to engage with your organizations. I can help your products become more widely adopted. Now, that's value to an organization. And when I talk in those terms, they get it. They're like, oh, okay. And then out to the patient community is the same thing. I help the patients understand how to engage with the system in a way that's more beneficial for them and less fearful. Because truth is, and we all know it, whenever we need to engage with the system, it's because we have something typically going wrong. So to diffuse some of that fear, especially around a cancer diagnosis, since that's what I know, that's value. So what are your value propositions? And how can we convey on a more business level our work in advocacy? So the picture with the silhouette and the dollars, that's ROI. What are the dollars and cents for what we do? Because if we can't quantify our value and turn it into either revenue creation or cost savings or expanded markets, broader adoption, industry doesn't bite. And from my experience on the patient, from my time on the Patient Experience Council, that's what we ran up against in talking to industry. We love what you're doing. We love that you have a collective team of patient and caregiver experts, but unless you show me how you're going to make me money, I'm not going to spend any. So I think it's important for us to think about what are our niche areas and how can we create that quantified monetary value. The solution, just that, what solutions can we really nail for particular stakeholders? Who are the stakeholders that you most resonate and align with? For me, it's startups, software development firms. I used to sell software, so I get that world. Usability, I can help them develop products that more patients will use. You know, the other solutions, or the other stakeholders are pharma. Pharma has a really hard time touching patients. So as that bridge, I can help them communicate the value of their solutions, not necessarily sell the product, but communicate the value of the solution to the patient so they can better understand the importance of clinical trials or the value of new medications or new advancements in medical devices. And that's real value to organizations. And then the art is the piece that I want to emphasize. Learning, for me, the art of listening, the art of persuasion, the art of negotiation. This is very, very important when we're having these business conversations within the industry. And I think we really do have to look at our advocacy work as a business. I've been using new terms as culture of empathy. I can help an organization create a culture of empathy by helping their employees really understand how their work every day impacts patients and put a face on it, put an emotional bent to the work so that people find their work more meaningful. Business of patient engagement. This is where I encourage organizations to really think about the investment in human capital that needs to be made, to look to the patient experience subject matter experts that we are, and the caregiver subject matter experts that we are, and invest in our intelligence, in our intellectual property. System level patient and caregiver integration, having us involved early on in the process and at a high level, be it in a development of a product, a program, or a service, is ideal. But at any point along the spectrum of development and implementation, we can add value. So at a system level, if patient integration occurs, I believe patient engagement on the ground will be much more widely embraced, and we'd be able to get more patients taking empowered steps for their health. Patient and caregiver life flows, also known as workflows. How do we align clinical workflows with patient and caregiver life flows? There's a big gap, and if we can learn to help industry close that gap, that will help clinicians improve patient satisfaction and outcomes and the other issues that they say are important, and I believe they believe they're important, but we can help them move the needle on actually success in those areas. And then, as I talked about, being the bridge and ROI. So it's looking at your story, thinking about your strategy, and that's a great path to success. And we know from examples of those who've preceded us with Regina and Dave and others. So my final closing word is keep calm and sell your story.
Rise when I get